Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Born to Talk Radio Show. I'm your host, Marcia Witeka. Conversations plus connections equals community. Those are my three C's. The heart of my show is, what's your story? It's my belief we all have stories. Some are similar, others are uniquely different. Storytelling brings the passions of my guests to life through our conversations. So be prepared to be entertained, informed, and inspired. Welcome to today's show. Hello, everybody. Happy Monday to you, wherever you might be. I'm very excited to have my guest today. Her name is Lissa Warren, and I'm going to spell her name for you. It's L-I-S-S-A, so there's two S's in Lissa, and Warren has two R's, W-A-R-R-E-N. And Lissa has been a literary publicist for more than 25 years. Since 2003, she's been an adjunct professor at Emerson College, where she teaches graduate and undergraduate courses as part of their writing, literature, and publishing program. She is so, so accomplished, and she's owned her own company since 2019 called Lissa Warren PR. And she's written two books. I mean, we are talking accomplished. Welcome to the show, Lissa.
Thank you, Marcia. It's lovely to be with you.
Oh, it's just a pleasure. And, you know, because of you, Lissa, I had probably one of the most listened shows I've ever had last week because of the clients that you gave me last week that shared my show with me. It was with Adira and Risa, and it was very well received. And I have no doubt that this show will be received as well. So why don't you just spend some time and just tell us a little bit more about your background, because it's pretty remarkable.
Sure. I grew up in Ohio, and then I moved north to the Boston area upon graduation from my undergrad, and I majored in English education as an undergrad and thought that I would go and teach high school English, but I did a little bit of that and realized I like the kids and I like the material, but I don't really think the kids really want to know about the material. They're not as excited about it as I am, no matter how hard I try. So I realized that teaching at the high school level was not for me, and so I got an internship, an unpaid internship in publishing at a company called David R. Godin, which is a wonderful literary press here in the Boston area, and stayed there for 4 or 5 years, migrated to Houghton Mifflin, wonderful legendary publisher, where I thought for sure I would die, because one never leaves Houghton Mifflin. I mean, it's sort of the pinnacle of Boston publishing. But then a little bit after that, I got wooed away by a startup company called the Perseus Books Group. And I stayed there for more than 20 years through a purchase that they had by the Hachette Book Group, which is one of the big five publishing houses. So I started off as an unpaid intern, and I ended up a VP at one of the big five houses. And then I decided to hang my own shingle and be a literary publicist on my own, which is what I do full-time now.
I think that's so, everybody's path to where they become professionally is a little bit different. I mean, that's why when I say, what's your story, I'm truly interested in the stories of my guests, and yours is no different. And I understand you worked in-house at various publishing companies, but what made you want to do that for a living?
You know, I loved books, and I loved being surrounded by other people who loved books. And so when I graduated from my undergrad, I went to Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, which is near Cincinnati. I came up to Boston, and I didn't know anybody. And so, you know, I hadn't grown up here. I knew no one. And the people that became my people were people in book publishing. And we had the same interests, the same likes. Why wouldn't you want to spend your life surrounded by other people who share your passion? in this case, my passion for books. So that's why I wanted to do it for a living. I thought I would be an editor, which is very common. You know, a lot of English majors think that that's what they're going to do. And I did try editing a bit. I acquired and edited 4 books when I worked at Perseus. But I found it to be lonely work, and I'm rather extroverted. So I found editing to be excellent work for an introvert, but it just didn't really suit me. So I gravitated toward publicity, which is all about talking to media people like yourself and talking to authors all day long. Perfect for an extrovert. So it really was kind of my calling in a way, I suppose.
It's nice when we sort of understand ourselves. It makes life a little bit easier. Did you toy with the idea of a different career?
I wanted to be a dancer very early on in my life. I studied dance for 18 years, and I took enough ballet to have the modern, which was my favorite form of dance, modern dance, not be sloppy. I think I could have made it, Marcia, if I had really, really applied myself, but books were always right there, and it just seemed like a more practical career. And I knew that with dance, your career is somewhat limited in terms of the number of years. Mm-hmm. Yes, you could go on and become a choreographer and all of that, but for practicality's sake, books made a whole lot more sense to me than dance did. But gosh, I did always love being in a dance studio.
Oh, that's so nice. Well, and so I would imagine that you enjoy going and seeing ballet performances now, right? I mean,
sure.
You still probably love ballet.
Absolutely. I mean, any kind of dance performance, I always enjoy watching.
Absolutely. So how did you get yourself started in the industry that you're in now?
I applied for internships, and back then, publishing internships were all unpaid. That has changed now. Now you can get your nice minimum wage or slightly minimum wage plus internship, but that was how I began. I looked in a book that offered, internship listings and just applied to everyone that I saw. And the funny thing is, the one that I wanted the most very early on was an internship at a company called David Argo Dean, and I applied for that my senior year of undergrad, and I did not get the position. I still remember the name of the lovely woman who interviewed me by telephone from Ohio. Her name was Winnie Dannenbarger, and she didn't offer me the position. And you know what? Now, looking back, she was right not to. I loved books, but I had zero skills, and I really was more interested in being a writer at that point than promoting other people's writing. So she was right to sense that and not give me the position, but I reapplied for it a year later, a summer later, and that time there was a different person doing the hiring. Her name was Sadie Ranson. I will be forever indebted to her, and I got the internship and just kept working until they started feeling so guilty that I'd been there way past the end of the internship that they said, okay, we're gonna start paying you. What should we give you as a title? And I was like, I don't know, editorial and publicity assistant, maybe? How is that? And they're like, sure, that's fine. So that was how it all began for me. That was how I got my start. And I haven't looked back.
What year was that?
My gosh, that was 1994.
Isn't that something? Isn't it something when we look back at the choices that we make and how it impacts not just ourselves but our families and just, there's something to be said by looking back at those memories and seeing where we are today. Because frankly, to be honest with you, Lissa, I am the same person I was in elementary school. I really am. I am that same person. I'm just an older version of that person that never shut up, always was interested in talking to somebody, never met a stranger, never really paid attention in school because I was too busy yapping. And but it's true. I mean, I didn't know then that this would be something that I would always do because I just really love people. And I'm really curious.
Found your groove.
Yeah. I did. I really did. So what has kept you in your industry for all this time? What's kept you there?
in addition to the people being surrounded by others who love books, the vast variety of books that I've had the opportunity to work on really made me stick with it. You know, I sometimes publicize novels, everything from historical fiction and literary fiction to, I've even done a few thrillers and mysteries before, to nonfiction in just about every category that you could possibly think of, everything from business books to history to biography to memoir to health books. And I had always, as a child, been interested in health and science, and I now have the opportunity to work with some really wonderful books in that space, in that category, and some really, you know, fascinating authors who have PhDs and MDs. And I was never exposed to that. I never had that kind of access as a kid growing up in Ohio. And I have access to that now. And I think the thing that keeps me intrigued, in addition to the variety, is the fact that I feel like I'm a lifelong learner, that every book I work on is like a crash course in some new subject or some new era of history or some new person that the biography is about. So I'm learning all the time, and I love that. I mean, you mentioned that you're a very curious person. I'm a very curious person, too. And this career scratches that itch for me in a big way.
I bet. I bet it does. I can see how that would be the case. And is your role in book publishing different now than it was then?
It is. I mean, the mechanics of the job haven't changed a ton, but what's different now is because I have my own book publicity firm, I'm able to choose which books and authors I want to represent. When you work in a publishing company, the editors acquire the books, they sign them, they publish them, and you just kind of get what needs to be gotten. I mean, you have a big, long list of titles that are being published in any given season, and you sort of divide them up among the people in your department, and you do have some say, usually, in which ones you handle, but, you know, you end up working on books that maybe you don't love in subject matters that aren't of as much interest to you, or with mm-hmm. authors who aren't as lovely to deal with. Now I have the wonderful position of being able to be selective, being able to be choosy. So it is different in that way. But I will also say that when I started in publishing, Marcia, my gosh, I mean, not to date myself here, but we didn't have things like Twitter or Facebook
exactly.
or Instagram or TikTok. We didn't even have Amazon, I don't think, when we started. I mean, it was a long time ago, and we didn't have podcasts. Like, what's a podcast? We didn't have blogs. What's a blog? None of those things existed 30 years ago when I got into book publishing. So now I have all of these different categories of media that I can try. In particular, podcasts have really changed things for book publicists. There are so many more shows, so many more opportunities for our authors now. So I have seen that change, and it does seem seismic to me as a driving force in the industry for sales of books. You know, podcasts are really driving sales.
It's interesting that you said that, because as you were speaking, I'm thinking to myself, you know, back in the late middle 90s, nobody had the kind of technology and the instant technology. It's not like we didn't have mm-hmm. emails and things like that back then. But just, you know, things like having a Zoom meeting or a Microsoft Teams
oh, yeah.
meeting, who would have even thought that there was anything like that, you know? And let's mm-hmm. face it, there are a variety of podcasters and how we all use our own technology, and whether or not people monetize their technology, and whether their podcasts are just audio like mine are, or they're audio and visual. When I first started mm-hmm. doing this, I was actually, I don't know if you knew this about me, I was actually in a studio here in my community of Westchester, not Westchester, New York, but Westchester by Los Angeles International Airport where I live. And I did that in a studio where I did have video and audio and commercial breaks and all of those things. But the downside for that, here was the upside downside of that. That is how I started. And I'm grateful for Deborah Blaine for introducing and producing that for me. However, you could only be a guest on my show if you could drive to the studio.
Had to be in person.
And so you could imagine that that would have limited you and everybody else that I have this all across this country. And so when that opportunity came to a close and I learned about Blog Talk Radio, which is what I've been using for the past 6 years, 3 years in the studio, 6 years on Blog Talk Radio, it's allowed me this wonderful adventure of being with people everywhere. And yes, I know that there are plenty of podcasters that have, you know, the technology to make this, you know, visual, and that would be great. But I think that if your guests can express themselves in a way that shows their sincerity, their authenticity, their desire to share what they do, it comes across. We don't have to physically see you to understand how much you love what you do. And I think that that's really great that this is happening. So when you were talking about your role in publishing different now, do you like what you're doing now better than what you used to do?
I do. I like the flexibility that it affords. And, you know, living in Boston, there are some days where the weather is just not just awful, but treacherous. You know, you just do not want to have to drive to an office. There are times when you literally could not get in there. The roads are not plowed enough to exit the building kind of thing. Now I just wake up, I walk 20 or 30 feet from the bedroom to the living room, and there I can make it my office and just kind of camp out on the couch and correspond with media and authors from all over the country, even all over the world. So what's not like about that? I mean, it's just so simple and so easy. And my mom is 84, and I am an only child. And so having whatever flexibility I need to take her to a doctor's appointment or just take care of her anytime she needs it, I have that now. And I can make up for the hours that I might miss during the middle of the day by working a little bit that evening or over the weekend. So I do appreciate that very much. I like working for myself. I like working from home. I think some people would maybe find it lonely, but I'm interacting with people all day long, via email, via phone, via Zoom. So I'm not ever lonely. So, yeah,
right.
I'm very happy being freelance. I really am.
So people are listening, and I'm curious about this because people often ask me the same question. What's your typical work day like now? I know you said, you know, you work from home, but kind of weave for us what a typical work day looks like for you.
Sure. It often starts off with an early morning text from an author client. Saying something like, gosh, you know, would you have a few minutes to check in on how the campaign is going? Or maybe saying something, you know, just very logistic oriented, like, I haven't gotten the Zoom link for my interview that's at 3:00 this afternoon. Will you be sending that to me? Will I be getting it from the show directly? Do I need to nudge the show to remind them? What do I do? You know, so it starts off sometimes with one eye open and my glasses not even on yet, but the day begins and off I go. And then I spend a lot of my day on email drafting pitches for members of the media. And so I take a book that I have that is needing coverage, and I try to envision ways that I can get that coverage for it. If it's a nonfiction book, then I'm probably spending some of my day just listening to what's going on in the world, whether I have, you know, MSNBC on in the background or NPR on, or I'm just scrolling on the New York Times website or something like that. I'm just trying to figure out if there's anything going on in the world to which one of my authors can speak. And if there is something going on to which they can speak, I'm probably then going to reach out to the author and say, like, hey, there was a wildfire in wherever. What are your thoughts on that vis-a-vis what we need to do to combat wildfires and how climate change is the reason that we're having them? And they'll come up with maybe two or three bullet points of what their take is on the situation. And then I will craft that into a pitch that I can send out to the media in case they're looking for a talking head. you know, somebody who can speak authoritatively and with good credentials to whatever issue is going on in the world. So I spend a lot of my days listening to the news, figuring out what's going on and how my authors can speak to it, and then I spend some time scheduling my authors for interviews with members of print and broadcast media. I sometimes spend some time in the day putting together a recap for my authors of, you know, what is has already run, has already aired, what's to come, recaps of outlets that I've tried. Sometimes I'm on the phone with an author brainstorming, you know, gosh, have we tried Mother Jones magazine? Have we tried Orion magazine? You know, what more could we try?
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a lot of trying to think outside the box to get attention for these worthy books. And then sometimes stuff runs and airs, and so I'm going to share that via social media. You know, if we get a really big review, say, in the Wall Street Journal or the Boston Globe, I'm going to craft a little tweet about that and tweet that out. So it's just a lot of working online, phone, computer. But I like all of that stuff very much. And occasionally when I have an author who has an event at, say, a bookstore or a library, I might go to that event. Certainly if it's in the Boston area, I would. If it's just in New York, I might take a train down for that to be there to support them and just, you know, help them with all of the logistics that are necessary to pull off an event smoothly. So that's just sort of a slice of my day.
You know, a couple of things came to my mind. One is I was just thinking about TED Talks because so many people that are writers are comfortable speaking and can do a TED Talk. And I was also thinking about, do you involve books, audio books? Is that anything about what you also get involved in, or is that somebody else's gig?
I could specialize in audiobook publicity. There is a need for that. But in all honesty, I tend to just sort of wrap any campaign for the audiobook into the campaign for the printed book, because the truth of it is there aren't a ton of media outlets that will have authors on to talk about their audiobook. There are very few that
mm-hmm.
review audiobooks. I can think of Audiophile magazine, and I'm really not sure there's much more than that.
Okay.
I kind of think of the audiobook sales as deriving from the publicity that is done for the printed book. It kind of rides the coattails of the publicity
mm-hmm.
for the printed book. But a lot of people love listening to audiobooks. I'm not one of them. I like to
right.
curl up and turn pages, but it
sure.
it's what a lot of people who commute, have long commutes, it's how they get their books, or people who fly on airplanes a lot and like to be able to listen to audiobooks while they're midair.
Mm-hmm.
And even people who like to be able to plug in an audiobook while they're cooking or doing house cleaning or whatever it might be,
right.
That is a wonderful option for them. I think if you're an author, you should really be meeting your audience, your potential reader, in whatever format they want. And that includes printed books and audiobooks, but also, of course, ebooks. There are a lot of people who like to read their
right.
books that way.
Right. And let's not forget about the popularity that didn't used to be around years and years ago of book clubs, where
that's
people
true too.
Socially get together, and whether it's a group of women or it's couples or whomever, they get together and then they share a social time having read a book, and now they have this book club once a week, or maybe not once a week, but maybe once a month. I'm sure that has also played a significant part in what you're involved in as well.
Sure. We love it when a book club chooses a book that we're working on, us publicists. I mean, we adore that, not just because it means you're going to sell, you know, 10, 15, 20 copies, however many people are in the book club, although, you know, we always
right.
appreciate the sales, but we know that
sure.
that will generate word of mouth, that those
mm-hmm.
people will tell other people, oh, my book club just read this really great book. I think you'd like it too. And it goes just sort of viral in that way. So book clubs certainly do play an important role in spreading the word titles
right.
that are available. You bet.
I'm sure. You bet. So you've got a pretty neat side gig as well, and I think that this would be a great place for you to tell us about what else you do, because you are just really an accomplished woman. So let's hear about this, what you do.
Well, I should be candid and say that I probably would make more money like driving for Uber than I do on my side gig. But I dearly love my side gig. My side gig is that I'm an adjunct professor at a college here in the Boston area that has a really good program. It's the Writing Literature and Publishing Program. And they have graciously allowed me to create a graduate course on book publicity, which of course is what I do for a living. So I have been teaching that course for over 20 years now, and it's just a couple of nights a week that I head over to campus and, you know, have bright-eyed and bushy-tailed young students who want to learn how to promote other people's books. And every once in a while, there's a student who is part of the MFA track, and they are authors themselves, and they very astutely, I think, want to learn how to promote their own books with mm-hmm. the media and how to get the word out about them. So sometimes they're coming at it from the perspective of how this can help their own writing. But many of them, I would even say most of them, want to work in book publishing and want to either be book publicists or want to be editors but want to make smarter choices about the books that they acquire for publication, and they know that they need to sign books, to acquire books that have good publicity potential, because good publicity equals good sales. So,
sure.
You know, a lot of people who want careers in publishing take my class on book publicity, and it's a four-hour class, so it is long.
Wow.
It is 6 to 10 per night, and, you know, I work all day. So I work all day, and then I head to campus
wow.
and teach my graduate course until 10 o'clock at night. I'm lucky my apartment's about 10 minutes from campus, so
oh, that's
I get
good.
Home pretty quick.
How often does your class meet?
Each class, each section just meets
yeah.
once a week uh-huh. for 14 weeks. So it is, you know, 6 to 9 on Tuesdays, or that's, you know, one course, and then I sometimes do two courses a semester, so it might be 6 to 9 on Thursdays, give myself a little bit of a breather on Wednesday night in between. But
wow.
it's pretty intense, you know, and I have a lot of students who work full-time because it's graduate school. So many of them are employed full-time in all kinds of jobs, some in publishing, some not. So they come to me pretty tired with, you know, just enough time to get to campus and maybe grab a burrito on the way. You know, and then they've got a four-hour class, and it's mostly a lecture class, so it's a lot of note-taking for them. But they learn, and I know that they learn because they go on to get jobs in publishing, Marcia, and it makes me feel so good when I get an email from them and they say, oh, you know, I've got a second interview with HarperCollins. Would you serve as a reference for me? You know, I love that. Or, oh, my gosh, guess what?
Sure.
I just got a job at Candlewick, which is my dream children's book publishing company that I've always wanted to work at. And I got that job, and I'm, you know, thanks to you. But even if it's not thanks to me, even if it's just, you know, on their own that they got it, I'm just so proud of them. I tell them, you're my colleague now. You know, you're not my student any longer. I'm delighted you're my colleague. So that makes me pleased as punch when that happens. It happens a lot.
Listen, I'm sure that is so gratifying. I'm sure that, you know, I can just sort of feel my hand over my heart like, oh, gosh, that feels so good that I was able to contribute to this for this person. It's fabulous. We're, you know, you've been doing this a while now, and I can't believe, I mean, I don't even imagine what your day is like, but were you teaching, since this is an in-person class, were you teaching during COVID?
I was, and it was weird. I had a class that we had gotten in, I think, two classes into the semester, and we got an email while we were in class that, you know, went to all of the students and all of the faculty that said that they were shutting the school down temporarily because of this, you know, COVID thing that was out and about spreading like wildfire. And so we all kind of, you know, completed that night's class, gathered our stuff up and said, well, you know, I don't know when I'll see you, but, you know, maybe I'll see you in a few weeks or whatever, you know, but we'll be in touch. And boy, that was the end of the semester, Marcia. That was it. We never saw each other in person again. They immediately converted it to a Zoom class, a virtual class. And so I taught the rest of that semester virtually, and then I taught the next semester virtually, and then I taught the next 2 years virtually. So it was wild. I mean, I was lucky in that the way that my syllabus was structured, it transferred pretty smoothly to virtual.
Mm-hmm.
But there were other professors and other programs, you know, like how do you be a drama instructor or an audiology instructor where you're teaching people about, I can't imagine some of them, they just had to come up with these incredibly creative ways to make their class doable via Zoom. It was fairly easy for me to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, those students that I mentioned that work, you know, full days and then have that 4-hour class at night, it's one thing if you're in person, you know, there's a certain adrenaline that kicks in if it's in person.
Right.
Can you imagine a 4-hour lecture class via Zoom after you've worked full
no.
day? Those poor kids.
No.
Those poor kids. But
well,
they
you
did it.
Too.
They did it.
I mean, you know, it everyone is connected to that. And, you know, it's one thing to, I mean, most of us are familiar with some form of Zoom in some way, but when you have, I mean, what would be a typical amount of students in one of your classes? How many students would be in your courses for those 14 weeks?
For the graduate program, they cap it at 12 students. And so I would occasionally have a 13th or a 14th when someone would write me a compelling email saying, you know, I really want to do this as my career, or my first book's coming out next year. You know, I really need your class. I would stretch it a little bit to 13 or 14,
mm-hmm.
but usually 12. And I will tell you, surprisingly, you know, I felt as close to my students who I had via Zoom by the end of the semester as I did my students who were in person, because I
really?
Would always have, yeah, I really did. I would always have office hours virtually for the hour prior to class. And so any student that needed some one-on-one time, whether it was not understanding a concept and wanting a little clarification on something that I had taught,
mm-hmm.
or whether they just needed career advice, they would just sign up for a slot and we would just Zoom in advance of class. And I really got to know them very well that way. And those are the kinds of conversations that I have with my in-person students too, but then it's always kind of on the fly, you know, like they'd come up to me before class or at the break or after class. But to have, you know, like a good solid like half hour sometimes with them via Zoom to talk about their career goals or the book that they want to write or whatever it might be, I felt as close to them via Zoom as I did in person, which I was not expecting. I thought that
well,
was not going to be the case.
Yeah. I think that's pretty cool. And, you know, it would be interesting if they were actually feeling the same way, because, you know, sometimes you do pull adrenaline off of the people that you're sitting around in a class. You know, you've got 12 students and everybody's interested in the same subject. You can't always maybe get that same adrenaline rush on a Zoom call.
Mm-hmm.
But it beats the options. So, I mean, isn't it great that there were those options out there for your students to be able to do that and for you to be able to reach out to them and them reach out to you independently? I mean, you know, we do that with doctors. We do that with a lot of different people, all different
True.
Kinds of meetings. So I think that technology based on COVID kept your students engaged. Otherwise, I mean, what were you going to do? I mean, there wasn't really a lot of options at that point.
No,
so
they would have just had to table their goals, you know, and not get a degree. And, you know, I think that COVID, in retrospect, was an excellent opportunity to get a graduate degree because, you know,
you
had that block of time where you weren't missing much. It's not like you were going to be able to go out and have a lot of fun anyway. You know, so just buckle down, study. And I did have students that made that choice. I even had a few students, and I give them so much credit in the world. They did their entire graduate program via Zoom classes. They never once set foot on campus.
Isn't that
I mean, can you imagine being that motivated and that focused? I give them so much credit for that. I really do.
Well, I'll tell you, another thought that just came flooding through my brain was, my goodness, you could live someplace that was nowhere near getting onto campus, and you could be part of your program.
That's true. And some of them did. I actually had a student who lived in Portugal. She took my class from Portugal.
Oh,
you know, so
my goodness.
It did open up opportunities for people who were not just in other states, but other countries.
That's amazing. So, Lissa, I know that you are a published author yourself. And I want to talk about your books. Why did you decide to write your first book? And I'm going to say the name of it. It's The Savvy Author's Guide to Book Publicity, a comprehensive resource from building the buzz to pitching the press. So, you know, why did you decide to write that book?
I saw a need for it. I had smart authors asking me smart questions as their publicist, and I tried to give them as much of my time as I possibly could to answer the very legitimate questions that they had. But I also needed to publicize their book. I mean, my main responsibility was to my publisher, to the company that employed me, to get results, to get media hits that would translate into sales. So I didn't have all of the time that I would have liked to have had to answer questions and just sort of handhold them through the book promotion process. And also, Marcia, I found that people had a lot of the same questions. And so I was answering the same thing again and again. And I didn't mind it, but it just felt redundant. And I thought, gosh, you know, I should just like plug my brain into my computer and get all of this down on paper. And I talked with an editor friend who worked at the company that I was working at the time, and I said to her, you know, do you think there's a book there? Because she published some, you know, sort of news you can use books, which I guess is what I would consider my Savvy Author's Guide book to be. And she said, yeah, I do think there is a need for this. I don't know of a lot of other books on this topic, maybe one or two others. So you've got a pretty clean shelf. And then I said to her, well, you know, okay, what do I do? I said, do I try to get a literary agent? Like, how do I go about this? And she's like, yeah, that would probably be the best way to go about it. And I said, do you know anybody who agents these kinds of books, who represents these kinds of books? And she said, yeah, I think I know a woman that might be interested. So she hooked me up with that woman. And of course, that woman was not interested in it. She was like, no, I'm moving away from books on, you know, writing and publishing. She said, but I have a colleague who's an agent down the hall who I think might be right for this. Let me, you know, walk the proposal over to him and see what he thinks. And she did. And he became my agent. And he was able to get me a book deal. And then I buckled down and wrote The Savvy Author's Guide to Book Publicity as just sort of a data dump from my brain in 4 months. I wrote it in 4 months and, you know, kind of everything that I knew about book publicity at the time.
So for those of us that don't know the difference, and I think that this would be helpful, what's the difference between what you do and what a literary agent does?
That's a great question. I do often get approached to represent someone's book as a literary agent, and then I listen to them and I have to break it to them that that's not what I do. A literary agent is sort of the first person that a prospective author would, you know, would enter their world. You get a literary agent to help shape the proposal for your book. Now, if your book is fiction, you have to write the whole thing. So then an agent is really helping you to shape your manuscript. And that's true if it's a children's book, and that's true if it's a book of poetry. But if it is nonfiction, like history or biography or what have you, self-help, then you just write a proposal, which is maybe 20 or 30 pages, and it talks about how you would structure the book, what the content would be, and also about how you would publicize and market the book. You know, the opportunities for publicity and for getting the word out about the book. So the literary agent would help the prospective author to shape that proposal. And once the agent is happy with it and the prospective author is happy with it, then the agent goes out with it, which means they start shopping that proposal around to editors at publishing houses that they, the agent, have identified as being potential good homes for it. And a really good agent doesn't just think, oh, you know, I'll try this publishing company. They think, I will try this editor at this publishing company, and I will try this editor at this publishing company, because they know the interests of the various editors at the various houses. And the editor then evaluates and helps the author evaluate the various offers that they receive from editors. Sometimes an agent will have a book that's so hot that there's a bidding war for it. Other times an agent sends it out broadly and is only able to get like one or two editors that want to make an offer. But they will help the author evaluate any one offer or multiple offers and choose the house that is really ideal for their book. And the editors, they take good care of their authors, but every once in a while, a literary agent does need to kind of jump back in and guide the process a bit. So that's what agents do. The literary publicist, which is what I do, we just try to get media for our authors and their books. We try to get them on radio and TV and podcasts. We try to get them in newspapers and magazines and on major websites like Literary Hub and Daily Beast and Salon and Slate. So that's how I spend my days. And publicists also arrange events for authors at bookstores and libraries and other venues. So that's certainly part of what a publicist does too. Agents do not pitch the media. Agents pitch editors to get the author the book deal. So that's the difference between the two.
That's really interesting. I would imagine most people don't know that. And I know I didn't know that. So when you wrote your books, and I want to talk about that in just a moment, more about it, you went through a literary agent. Is that right? Is that what you did?
That's right. Yeah, that's how I got published. I might have been able to get a book deal myself, but, you know, the secret is a literary agent can generally get an author more money for their book, which we call an advance. They can usually get a larger advance than an author would be able to get on their own because they can haggle. You know, they can go back to the editor and stand their ground and say,
sure.
No, I don't think $10,000 is enough for that. The minimum my author could take is $15,000, or, you know, maybe it's, I don't think $100,000 is enough. We want a minimum $150,000. A gutsy agent, a pushy agent, can sometimes get you a lot more money than you could get on your own. And also they will make sure that you land at a house that has good distribution and a house with editors who are really known for a book, you know, helping the author really craft it. There are some editors who just sort of push a book as it's received, you know, from the author into the production process, and they don't really roll up their sleeves and get their hands dirty and make the language sing. You know, they don't really edit. They acquire the book for publication, but they don't really edit it. But good agents know where the good editors are, the editors who are going to roll up their sleeves. So I knew that I needed to have the guidance of an agent, and I was very, very glad I found a good one, and I was very, very glad that he was able to find a home for my book.
Sure.
And that was my first book.
What, did you have fun promoting it? Was that fun for you since you're the promoter for so many others? Did you?
Yeah, it
That's
was
cool.
really fun. I got to go to a lot of writers' conferences. There's a really good one here in Boston called Grub Street, and then I went and spoke at the New Hampshire Writers Project and the Cape Cod Writers Project, and then I also got invited by some universities that had creative writing programs to come and speak to their students about book promotion. So I got to go and give a lot of talks and meet a lot of people and, you know, sign books at the back of the room kind of thing after I was done giving my presentation. But it was fun to be on the other side of it for a change. I'll admit it. I love being a publicist. But it was nice to have my little 15 minutes for me.
Just fame.
Yeah,
oh,
my
gosh.
15 minutes. It was fun.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you've written another book. And I think this is a very fascinating book because it's very personal. It's a memoir. And it's called The Good Luck Cat, How a Cat Saved a Family and a Family Saved a Cat. You've got some time to share that story with us, if you would, please.
Sure. It is a memoir represented by the same literary agent. He stuck with me, even though this was a very different one than the first one that I published. You're right about that. This book is the story of my family and a little 7-pound gray cat that we got from a breeder. Her name was Ting Pei Warren, and we thought that we were being crazy clever to name her Ting Pei because we wanted something that just sort of sounded Thai to us, and, you know, we didn't, know any Thai people to check it with. It turns out that her name meant trash can in Thai, so oops about that. We should have checked. I got her from my father when he retired. He had coronary artery disease, and he had a quadruple bypass where if not all of the grafts took terribly well. And so he had to retire early, and my mom was still working, and I was by then working full-time, you know, had all grown up. And so he was by himself during the days and, you know, was lonely. And so I got him this little gray Karat cat from Thailand, and they were best buddies. They were fast companions, and she just changed our family in the way that a truly amazing pet can sometimes change a family. And then when my father passed away from a heart attack, you know, my mom and I were bereft, and the cat was bereft, and it you know, was just an incredibly, incredibly hard thing for us. We managed to make it through, you know, a few years of the new normal, you know, that you kind of adjust
right.
to when you've learned it, when you've lost someone. And then the cat started having these fainting spells, his cat. And we thought, you know, boy, this really isn't good, and took her to Angel Animal Medical Center, which is this amazing animal hospital here in the Boston area. We're so fortunate that they exist and that they diagnosed her problem. She had AV block, which meant that the electrical impulses weren't getting through to all parts of her heart, and that's why she was having these fainting spells. And we were told that the only thing that would save her was a heart surgery that she needed a pacemaker. And then
were
told that they don't, I know, but listen to this, they don't make pacemakers for cats. So they said they would need to implant a human pacemaker in our little 7-pound cat. I know.
Oh, my goodness.
I know. And we were like, how often is this done? Is this successful? And they were like, it's done more than you think. It is successful, but it's, you know, very expensive, and it's intense, and she's going to need a lot of care afterward. And, you know, we're up to try it if you are. And so my mom and I, you know, went home, thought about it a little, but honestly, Marcia, like, we knew it was the right thing to do for her. And so we proceeded to have a pacemaker implanted in our cat. And, you know, I don't want to give away the ending too much here, but it had a happy ending. And this is the story of that odyssey to figure out what was wrong with her and get her through that surgery and get her healthy again. You know, Marcia, we didn't want to lose another family member to heart disease. You know, we'd lost my dad, and we weren't going to let that happen to his cat. And so this book is that story. And, you know, it's a very personal story, but I think for many people that have pets, it's a very universal story. There's nothing they wouldn't do for their animal, whether it's, you know, cancer treatment or, you know, whatever that pet needs, your dog, your cat, whatever it is, your ferret, you'd go to the ends of the earth for it. I hope it's relatable in that way.
I'm sure it is, and I can relate. I mean, I don't have that serious of a condition with my cat that depends on me, but I'm certainly my cat's mommy, and, you know, I will do whatever it takes to keep her healthy, to get her to eat, to get her to do whatever she needs to do, because I feel committed to her. I want her to live a healthy life, and if I have to do this or that or whatever, you know, that's what I'll do. And I don't, you know, and I have plans in place. If I have to be at a sporting event or I have to go somewhere where somebody else needs to come in and feed her, you know, I arrange for that. I live alone. What am I going to do? I'm not going to just walk away and say, well, good luck. Let me know how that turns out. So I can relate to what you're saying. And then when you connect the fact that your dad and this cat, there's even something more dramatic there and more personal. So I just think it's amazing, and I'm sure you must have done a lot of effort to promote this one as well, didn't you?
I did, and it was fun. I think the high point in a lot of ways was doing a talk at a local cat shelter, you know, and they had book signing, a little talk and a little book signing, and I felt so welcomed by them, and I was afraid that I would not be welcomed because you know, I was honest in the book that we got this cat from a breeder, and there they were with, you know, dozens of homeless cats, you know, like cats that
right.
needed families, and they took such good care of them. And, you know, I felt guilty. Like we could have adopted a shelter cat, you know, but we didn't. Instead, mm-hmm. we spent money and got like a really fancy one. And I thought they would judge me for that. And they didn't at all. They were like, you know, great that you have a cat that you love and you went to the ends of the earth for. And I ended up volunteering at that cat shelter because I had such a lovely experience promoting my book there for 3 years, until COVID. And I was the person who would interview potential adopters and tell them about the different cats that we had. And I would get to kind of matchmake them a little bit depending on, you know, their family and what they were looking for. And that was just pure joy, pure joy. So it ended up, you know, leading to a really nice relationship with that cat shelter. And it was just a super fun event. So that was the high point of my promotion of the Good Luck Cat.
You bet. So not that you have any time for this, but is there a third book out there that's brewing in your life?
I hope so. I think the one that I would like to do is sort of a prequel to The Savvy Author's Guide to Book Publicity, and it would be The Savvy Author's Guide to Getting Published. Sort of everything that an author needs to know when putting a book proposal together, when trying to find a literary agent, when evaluating different offers from different publishing houses, you know, everything they need to know to find the right place and the right situation for them and their book. So I would like to be able to be a guide to authors at that early stage, having had the opportunity and really finding it very fulfilling to be a guide to authors post-publication when they're promoting their book. So I think that's the next one I would like to do. But, you know, I gotta get a proposal together. I gotta shop it. I gotta get my agent
to
start sending it out. Yep.
Well, that's you got to write it first. You got to put something in writing,
that's
right?
Lovely thing. You have to put something in writing, exactly. But that's the lovely thing about nonfiction. You don't have to write the whole book. You just write like maybe a 20-page proposal, and that's what the literary agent goes out to the editors with. And then if you have an editor who bites, they give you a contract, and then you write the rest of the book.
That's interesting. I know that I do have a lot of authors that are on my podcast, and some of these people are definitely self-publishing. What is your thoughts about people self-doing their own publishing?
I think it's the hard way to go. I really do.
You
have no other option, if you have been trying for months to get a literary agent and are not having any luck, if you've been submitting your book to publishing houses directly, you know, meaning without a literary agent, and you're not getting any takers, and you've just exhausted all possibilities, and you just really, really want your book to see the light of day, okay, self-publishing is an option, but when you self-publish, instead of getting paid for your book, instead of receiving an advance, you have to pay the publisher. So financially, it is not just not lucrative, it can be quite costly. I know people who've spent $20,000, $30,000, $50,000 self-publishing their book. It ain't for the faint of heart financially.
Mm.
And another thing to go into it, you know, eyes wide open with, is that you are not going to get a person who is in charge of doing a marketing campaign for your book. You are not going to get a person at the publishing company who is in charge of doing a publicity campaign for your book. The editing that you receive is sometimes minimal. The covers sometimes look nice, but sometimes the cover design is really not up to par. So sometimes you can tell a book is self-published just by the not-so-good book cover. So, you know, my advice would be, if you're going to self-publish, choose wisely. Choose a press that is really, really good. Look at books that they've published. Make sure they look sharp. You know, read some of the books that they've published and make sure that they are well edited and not a lot of typos and stuff like that. All self-publishers are created equal. Just be prepared to spend a lot of money. And frankly, you're probably going to want to hire a freelance publicist to do the publicity for your book, because you're not going to have somebody at the publishing company whose job it is to do that. So that's going to be an extra expense for you if you really want to get the word out about your book. It's a tough way to go.
It sounds like it. You know, it's amazing. You know, I write a blog, and I always, connect books when I have books to Amazon so that people can easily just find their books there. And purchasing books today has become so simple because that's not to say you can't go into Barnes and Noble or some, bookstore. Those are important, and I realize that, they also have a website, but I know that with the advance of technology and Amazon that, people can just order their books from the comfort of their home. So it's an interesting process. But it sounds like you're still teaching now too, is that right?
Yeah, I am. I'm still teaching my graduate class at Emerson.
Wow.
What
day of the week do you teach?
I usually teach two courses a semester, one on Tuesday nights and one on Thursday nights. But this coming fall, I'm only going to have the Tuesday night section. So
it will
seem like a light semester. It will seem like a light load. I don't know what
I'm
going to
do
with myself. Maybe I'll get the proposal done for that next book and use the time for that. That would be a very good use of it, right? Hold me accountable
Marcia.
Check back in
with me. You crack me up because that is a perfect segue to what I was just about to ask you. So when you're not working and you're not teaching and you're not writing, I don't know what time you've got left, but do you have any hobbies? Are there things that you love to do when you're not doing all those other things that you do?
Kind of not, but maybe a little. I mean, I love my job, plural. I love my teaching, and I love my book publicity.
Yes.
Obviously, I like to read, in my spare time, but I do so much reading for work that, that reading is maybe not as pleasurable as it used to be when I was purely reading for fun. One thing I found that I love doing is jigsaw puzzles. And,
too.
It's nice. Oh, you do them too. There you go. How many pieces do you like to do? 500,000?
Well, okay.
What do you like?
Well, okay. So let me be forward and straight about this. They're not laid out on my table. I do it on my iPad.
Computer.
But it's something that I do every single day on my iPad. The jigsaw puzzles are free, and I move those puzzle pieces around, and it's just my quiet time.
It's relaxing,
I'm assuming you,
right?
It is. But I'm sure when you're talking jigsaw puzzles, I presume you're actually physically touching these pieces, right?
I do both. I play them on my computer, but then I also I do both. I like the 500 piece puzzles because, it's still tough to do and still requires time, but it doesn't feel like a marriage level commitment that you would have to a 1,000 piece puzzle. So my favorite is the actual, get it in a box and shake it and hear it puzzle inside and clear off the table so you can put it together. That's my favorite way of doing it. And I find I like puzzles in sections. I don't know why. I just find them easier that way to put together. So, I like jigsaw puzzles. And the other thing that I'm really into, and especially at this time of the year, I like to plant flowers on my deck and make these pretty little potted arrangements of them. So I just had the pleasure of going to the nursery and buying all of my flowers for this year and decking out the deck with flowers.
That's so cool. You made me think about something. I don't mean to keep turning these things back to me, but this past Christmas, I got my son and his wife live in Tucson. My daughter lives near me. And my daughter bought a jigsaw puzzle that we all worked together as a family, put it together, and then I had it framed. I had it put behind glass, and I framed it. And it's a memory now, and that's just so special. And,
that's awesome.
We need to make the best out of all that we do. And your website the actual physicality of your website is so beautiful. It looks like that could be a jigsaw puzzle. It's just beautiful. And Lisa's name, I'm saying Lisa, and I don't mean to say Lisa because that's just what rolls out. Lisa's name is LISSAWARRENPR.com. And when you go to that website, you will see precisely what I'm talking about because it's so beautiful. It's a beautiful part of your page, and I'm so happy that I feel like I was starting to go into a song that Carol Burnett used to sing, but I won't do that. But you know what I was going with is I'm so glad we had this time together because this really was enjoyable to share your story and to let people know that there are ways of getting their books written as well. And you've helped people understand that. And I think that that's just another special part of what this podcast has been all about with you and I today. It's just been wonderful, Alyssa, really.
Thank you, Martha. I've enjoyed it too.
You're welcome. You're welcome. So everybody, think about how this might inspire you to take your fingers to the keyboard or your hands to the paper and think about maybe something that you would like to write. And I'm going to let Lisa get on with her afternoon, and I will be back again next week because that's just what I do to enjoy my time. So thank you once again for joining me. And everyone have a wonderful, safe week. Bye for now, everybody.
We are audiosac.ai,
combining AI writing, the best synthetic voices,
with production and delivery,
be it ads, podcasts, or VOs for video.
Just like this ad. How would you utilize AI audio? For free.
Go to audiosac.ai/contest.
Give us just a few details.
And you could replace this spot and be heard by millions.
See webpage for T's and C's. audiosac.ai/contest.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.